Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. On Easter Sunday, a Taliban group took responsibility for a suicide bombing that set off explosives in a park in Lahore, Pakistan, where families were enjoying the day. The bomb killed 79 people, including 29 children, and more than 200 were wounded. Joining us to discuss coverage is Rafia Zakaria. She's a journalist and author of The Upstairs Wife, An Intimate History of Pakistan. Rafia wrote an op-ed for the New York Times about the bombing in Pakistan. Hi, Rafia. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
It's nice to have you. And on the domestic front, we are discussing coverage of anti-abortion laws. If you can't keep up with them, you're not alone. In the past few weeks, anti-abortion laws have been signed in Florida, Utah, and Indiana. In Utah, doctors are now required to give some women anesthesia. In Indiana, all fetal remains must be cremated or buried, even if they come from a miscarriage. In Florida, state funding for abortions is already prohibited, but a new bill cuts funding for preventive services at clinics that also provide abortions. And then Donald Trump is receiving nonstop media coverage for backtracking after he said that women who get abortions should be punished. Ted Cruz and anti-choice activists are condemning the remarks, but women are already being punished, and in many cases, they're being forced to give birth. We just did a show about the documentary Trapped that gave a voice to a number of these women. Jody Jacobson, one of today's guests, has a piece called Punish Women for Abortion, Spare the Outrage. That is mainstream anti-choice positions. Jody Jacobson is president and editor-in-chief of Rewire, formerly known as RH Reality Check. Rewire provides news, analysis, commentary, and reporting on reproductive and sexual health and justice. Hi, Jody. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. I'm so glad to be with you here.
It's great to have you. And we are also joined by Megan Winter. She's a freelance journalist based in New York. Oh, we're going to be joined by Megan in just about 30 minutes. Last year, Megan wrote a piece about crisis pregnancy centers, and her latest feature is called Roe v. Wade was lost in 1992, and it's published in Slate, and she'll be joining us in about 30 minutes. So as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and highlight journalism that was done well and stood out this week. So let's start with you, Jody. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I'm going to be really honest and tell you that I have had very little time for outside reading because we've just launched our new website and we've been a little bit frantic since then just getting everything done. But we did have a piece that I would commend to people if I could be a little bit self-serving, which is a piece by Sharona Coots, our VP and Director of Investigations and Research, which looks into a new effort by anti-choice groups to trick teens into thinking they've signed away their abortion rights and then trying to indict their parents if a parent brings them to an abortion clinic. It's a really nefarious thing. It seems to be part of a larger effort by the anti-choice community to infiltrate schools and other places where teens might be and might have gotten pregnant and then to circumvent parental authority. And taking these teens, bringing them to crisis pregnancy centers, and having them sign bogus documents they don't understand.
And who put these documents together?
There is a group called Life Dynamics, which is a sort of under-the-radar but major anti-choice actor, which gets money from the Wilkes brothers. These are billionaires who are also funders of Ted Cruz's campaign, and they are major anti-choice donors. They are major funders of Life Dynamics, and they've got a slew of people working with them, and they've now publicly said that they are training quote-unquote spies to infiltrate clinics, schools, and other places in order to basically, you know, spy on people and try to influence their life choices.
All right, so kudos to Sharona Coots for this piece, anti-choice activists using bogus legal threats trick teens into signing away abortion rights. And also kudos to Rewire. This is a website that was just relaunched, formerly RH Reality Check. I hope you can check it out. There's just so many really great stories at Rewire that do not really get much attention in the national media. And Jody Jacobson is editor-in-chief of Rewire. Thank you for that. And what about you, Rafia? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I mean, on the domestic front, I think in terms of women and women's writing, I wanted to bring attention to the 2015 Reader Count, which counts the number of bylines for women in major publications. And I thought that that was something, you know, that came out today, the whole story, and the New Republic covers it. And I would highly recommend that all listeners to your show go and check that out in terms of which major publications in the United States were publishing women and publishing women of color. It shows that, you know, things have improved in the past few days when they started. The Reader Count basically counts the number of bylines that women got over the year in major publications. And, and again, they have the count for different publications. And they're showing that since they started to do that, there has been a significant improvement both in the number of women writing opinion columns, reviews, features in American publications. And that was pretty hopeful. And they also counted the women of color who are able to write in major publications or asked to write and who get bylines. And that number, of course, is not as good as you would want it to be. But it's a start. And I think that that is definitely something that people should think about, particularly women who are interested in writing and in promoting the work of other women. I would definitely, it's at the New Republic. I think the New Republic actually was one of the publications that showed that they published the highest number of women in this past year.
Well, great. So, I'm glad you brought that up, because someone mentioned that one of the magazines, I think it was Harper's, recently had all male bylines, mm-hmm. and I was wondering if Vita had an update. So I'm really glad that you brought this up today.
Yeah. See, this in 2015 for Harper's, they got 38% of the bylines. So that's still obviously, you know, it's not anywhere close to being equal, but it's better. It's better than it was. It's a 10% point increase from last year for Harper's. So, it just shows the fact that when you have these numbers and you show just how underrepresented women are, that publications and editorial staff are subject to some pressure and to thinking about this. The New Republic published 45%, and they were up 18% from 2014. So, and the Boston Review was 46%. It was up 33% from 5 years ago. The Atlantic was still at 40%. In most categories, men dominated in that publication. So I think that came out. Yeah, this came out this Wednesday, and it's a very, very interesting survey. It puts in numbers what I think a lot of women, both activists and writers and readers, have known, is that the female perspective is often ignored in the public narrative. And when you put the numbers out there, I think it's a great way to hold editorial staff at major publications accountable for, you know, what is a literal or a theoretical commitment to equality, but that doesn't always show in the numbers.
Right, and Vita gets a lot of credit for this because they're the ones that put out these numbers and then they pressure the publications to do better. That's VIDA. And Jody, just quickly, what does research show about who writes articles about reproductive rights and abortions? I know that in the last election, various organizations found that the majority of the people who were quoted in the articles were men.
Well, I think it's such an interesting thing, because in the mainstream media, Yes, the majority of people who appear on shows to talk about, who are quoted in the mainstream media, and I believe even who write articles on abortion, are in fact men. And I find it really upsetting, not only that men are predominantly featured in these conversations, but that because of that, they're often too squeamish to ask really important questions. And they also fail, I think the media fails in another regard, which is they fail to talk to actual real women and or providers, and instead talk to political people or other media, and so get a skewed view of what needs to happen, what is actually happening, you know, what is really medically necessary. Those kinds of things are debated among people who, on the anti-choice side, have a complete political agenda that they're trying to pursue, and yet those things never get questioned. And I truly think, after observing this, that a lot of men in the media are deeply uncomfortable talking about these things. That's their problem, but they shouldn't be talking about them from a reportorial point of view if they can't talk about them with authenticity.
Well, we are definitely seeing that pattern in the past 24 hours with what Donald Trump said, but we will talk about that later in the show. That is Jody Jacobson. She's editor-in-chief of Rewire. They provide news and analysis about reproductive rights. And Rafia Zakaria is a journalist and author of The Upstairs Wife, An Intimate History of Pakistan. And you can find these pieces at yourcallradio.org.
And I literally just bought her book online while we were talking.
Oh,
wow, that's fantastic.
That's great.
That's what I hope everybody's doing, you know.
I hope so, too.
Listening to this. Yep.
Well, and you can find also Rafia's op-ed in the New York Times that she wrote called The Playgrounds of Pakistan at yourcallradio.org. And let's talk about this horrific suicide bombing that happened last week on Easter Sunday in Pakistan, Rafia. It killed 79 people, including 29 children, wounded more than 200, and a Taliban group took responsibility. It was a suicide bomber in a park in Lahore, Pakistan. According to reports, families were there just enjoying the day. Why was this park targeted?
Well, Gulshan Iqbal Park is, it's a big public park in what is, middle-class, working-class neighborhood in Lahore, which is very, very heavily populated. Sunday is, the only holiday in Pakistan, like everywhere else. It's a day when families get together. It's also spring in Lahore, which, the city actually has a very long tradition of having, spring festivals and people coming out to enjoy the warmer weather and the, flowers and everything else. And so this park was, definitely a place where there were people from the neighborhood, a lot of children. It was 6 o'clock in the evening, kind of the peak of the period where people are at the park. It was also Easter Sunday. A few weeks ago, the Pakistani government, in an effort, to sort of make an official statement in favor of tolerance and harmony and, and inclusion of minorities, had declared, Easter and actually all Christian and Hindu holidays, national holidays in Pakistan. And, of course, there are people, particularly the Taliban and other extremist groups who are upset about that. And the attack, it was Easter Sunday, but it was also Sunday. So, everybody was out that day. And the attack, it was obviously a soft target, the 4-foot boundary wall to the children's area of the park. And, the blast went off, like you said, about almost, more than a third of the people who died were children. And, in the media, there's been some, a lot of questioning, they were targeting minorities and they were targeting Christians. But while they may have been targeting Christians, the fact is that the majority of victims were Muslims. So 14 of the 79 people, I believe, according to the Pakistani press, were Christian, and everyone else was Muslim, which is, which is expected because, of course, you know, the country is majority Muslim, and, you know, there's no sort of, you go to a park, there's no kind of demarcation between who is Muslim. And it's a very important point because this is how these extremist groups operate in terms of, you know, highlighting that difference and trying to cover what they're doing by the fact that, oh, we weren't targeting Muslims. But then the fact is that they were targeting everyone. They were targeting innocent children and civilians. They didn't care who died from the attack. They didn't care that they were mostly women and children. And I think that that point deserves to be underscored because, this is an important time for Pakistan. The government, unlike previous governments at least, has made overtures in an effort to, make public and official statements that all Pakistanis, regardless of their religion, are Pakistani citizens and deserve a full all their rights. And the religious extremists are very, very angry about that. And unfortunately, in this incident, it was the children who paid the price, of their just grotesque agenda.
And Rafia, talk about the angle you chose to focus on in your New York Times op-ed piece. You write that for much of the world, the deaths of Pakistani children are forgettable. For example, you write that in December 2014, Taliban militants gunned down more than 140 people at a school in Peshawar, a vast majority of them students. A former American ambassador, speaking of his government's lack of desire to help the Pakistani government fight extremists, said, quote, "There is great Pakistan fatigue in Washington." Can you talk about that and the angle you chose to focus on?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I was focusing on the very core of sort of central idea of children at a playground, and I was connecting it to my own memories of growing up in Pakistan and playing in playgrounds in Pakistan. And, you know, the playground is, I think, in many ways, a very symbolic place. I mean, children, like I write in the piece, are in their very small and innocent way invested in confronting and vanquishing their fear. It's a thrill, but it's also, you know, when you go down a slide or when you're high up on a swing, it's about feeling scared, but then overcoming that. And I wanted to bring that out because I think that, you know, places like Pakistan, and I'd include much of the Muslim world in that, are considered a sort of, you know, the sort of places where these things happen and that don't deserve the world's attention. I mean, it is deeply disturbing to me, for instance, the fact that, you know, when I wrote that op-ed, I wrote it on Monday, it came out, you know, on Wednesday, or Tuesday, actually, there were still live reports from Brussels, right, which that attack by that time had happened 8 days ago. Mm-hmm. Whereas in Pakistan, it had just happened 1 day ago, and in a day, it was gone from the headlines, and there was no sort of effort to dig deeper or see who had died or commemorate them in any way. And I think that, you know, it's not just a, oh, darn, they should give more coverage to Pakistan type of point. It's a larger point, I think, about the world's empathy and who the world considers true victims of terror. And I think that there's a terrible moral inequity in that. I think that we are very concerned and believe, the deaths of Westerners who die in terrorist attacks to be more real and more tragic, and we invest them with a greater moral innocence. And hence a greater, mourning than we do even children in Pakistan. I think that there is an unexamined belief that says that, okay, even these children are somehow complicit in what's happening to them. You know, they're the children of this country that harbors terror and all of this. And so, you know, so they died. Okay, well, they died. And, if you look at the comments on the article, you can see that. I mean, there's literally hundreds of comments there, over 100, that the vast majority of which are talking about how Pakistan deserves this. And I think that there is a very, very important and crucial point in that attitude, because it shows why and how these militant groups work. Because when you don't respect the victims of terror attacks, you essentially erase them from your consciousness. When you erase them from consciousness, then, you know, the precept that the war on terror is not about defeating extremism, but about protecting Westerners becomes true. And I think that that question lies at the heart of all of this. Why don't we mourn the children of Lahore? Why don't we mourn the dead?
And Jody, what are your thoughts on this? We just have an email from Chris who says, I noticed that the mainstream media, CNN, MSNBC, spent so much more time covering the Belgium attacks, not much time at all on Pakistan. What are your thoughts on this unequal media attention?
Well, First of all, I have to say, I mean, I feel compelled to say I'm so sorry, because I totally get what you're saying, and I see it. And I find it to be unconscionable about this country that for some reason we have decided that we are more important than everyone else. And if something happens in Europe or the United States, it's more important than everyone else. We could say that about Pakistan. We could say that about, you know, Syria. There are so many people dying and things going on where it almost seems like it's irrelevant in the debate. And my first you know, desires to just somehow say I'm sorry, because it's horrible, and I don't know that, you know, there's much that I can say of import, because except to recognize and acknowledge it. I wonder, you know, what you think, Rafia, that could be done or should be done by leaders in the United States to change that conversation, or do you think that they don't even have a desire to do so? Because, you know, if nothing else, we run around talking about life and pro-life and all this other stuff, and yet we are so dismissive of the lives of actual extant people who are living in these conditions or other conditions where their lives are at risk every day. And I just find it unconscionable. I wonder what you think could be done truly on the U.S. part, or by people in the U.S. who do care about this, to change things?
The first thing I think is to acknowledge that there's a problem. I mean, I have been talking and tweeting about this for months, and some of the responses I get, even from, and I mean, they are white males, but they're journalists who, you know, run big wire services and are in the leadership positions of these, or of South Asia bureaus or Middle East bureaus, and not all of them, but particularly men, are absolutely unwilling to recognize the fact that there's a difference. I mean, I remember particularly an exchange that I had on Twitter when I was talking about the bombing in Istanbul, and you know, and I was saying that it isn't getting enough coverage, and he's like, well, it's reported, you know, it's there, there's a story. And the point that I'm trying to make is that, you know, it is reported, but it's, like I said in the piece, a news item. It's not a news event, you know.
Yeah.
And that is a very, very crucial difference, because unless we invest some reality in the suffering of people who are literally at the front lines of this battle, you know, I mean, in places like Pakistan, and the consequence of this is what I would like to highlight, which is that, you know, when I talk, for instance, university students in Pakistan, you know, the university in Pakistan is the campus is a very, very volatile place. And there are religious extremists that are constantly attacking these campuses. So the kids who go to school there, who are sort of pushing ahead for an education, who want to engage in a positive way globally, you know, feel that they're fighting the war on terror every day. And they are, because they are at risk every day for suicide bombings and attacks. But when they hear, or when they don't see that reflected, I mean, when they don't see any respect given to their sacrifice, what is done is essentially alienate them from from this discourse of this collective fight against terror. You know, people talk a lot about, oh, Pakistan or Iraq or Yemen, they need to own the war against extremism, and Muslims need to own the war against extremism. But when they do, you know, like the people in this park or the students in the university that was attacked in January, you don't give them any credit. There's no credit given to them. You know, they're not eulogized, even when they're dead. And the pathos of that, the pathos of 29 coffins, you know, of small children, that's an immense burden and on any country. And so I think that there needs to be some soul searching on the part of U.S. media, because this kind of erasure plays totally and exactly into the hands of groups like ISIS, of groups like Taliban, because they want Muslims to feel estranged from the rest of the world. Well, they want them to feel alienated.
We should do a show about this, because we also found a great article by Renee Graham with the Boston Globe called "Are All Terrorism Victims Equal? Not in the Media." And she writes that whatever attention the Lahore attack has received, it pales when compared to Brussels. For its victims, there were no heartfelt bits in the New York Times detailing their unfulfilled aspirations, how devoted a parent was to his or her children, or stories of someone's unfailing ability to brighten a room just by walking into it. Instead, those whose lives were destroyed yet again are nameless and faceless. So we should do a show about this, because unfortunately, every time this happens, we have this conversation, and it deserves a little more attention. So Rafia is a journalist. She's author of the book, The Upstairs Wife, An Intimate History of Pakistan. And then you can find her New York Times op-ed. It's called The Playgrounds of Pakistan. Find it at yourcallradio.org. Rafia, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. This is Your Call. After the break, we will talk about coverage of reproductive rights and abortion. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
Your Call on Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective to share in today's discussion you've not yet heard, or a question you feel needs to be answered, please join our conversation by calling 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also send an email, question, or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org. It's half past 10 o'clock, coming up at 11. Inflection Point with Laura Schiller here on KALW. Stay tuned.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we are starting a new week-long series examining the toxic chemicals in our everyday lives. We're going to kick off our first show with The Intercept's investigative reporter, Sharon Lerner, to talk about chemical regulations. There are over 60,000 chemicals in the U.S. with no oversight. Manufacturers say they don't have to disclose these chemicals that they use in the products because there are trade secret protections. So we'll talk about why that's happening and what's being done to close these loopholes. And then we're also going to talk about the toxins in our bodies, the toxins on our food, in our households. And if you have any questions you'd like us to raise during this week-long series, please email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today it is our media roundtable, and now we are going to talk about coverage of anti-abortion laws. We will also talk about Donald Trump, who's getting 24/7 media coverage once again for saying that women who get abortions should be punished. He said this during an MSNBC interview with Chris Matthews. He's since backtracked. And now we have people like Ted Cruz and anti-choice activists condemning the remarks. But women are already being punished. Jody Jacobson has a piece about this called Punish Women for Abortion, Spare the Outrage. That is the mainstream anti-choice position. Jody is editor-in-chief of Rewire, formerly known as RH Reality Check. They provide news and analysis on reproductive and sexual health issues. And now I would like to welcome Megan Winter to the show. Megan is a freelance journalist. Last year, she uncovered a complex network of donors, lobbyists, and lawyers behind the proliferation of crisis pregnancy centers across the country. And her latest lengthy story is published in Slate. It's called Roe v. Wade Was Lost in 1992. Hi, Megan. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's such an honor.
Well, it's great to have you. So before we talk about the coverage that Donald Trump is getting, I want to dive in and talk about your story because it's such a long story, and it looks at what is at stake for women's reproductive rights and how we really need to go back to 1992 to understand the erosion of Roe v. Wade. Talk about what happened with Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, the first woman on the court, when she introduced the idea of the undue burden allowing states to legislate abortion.
Sure. So I'll try to do as best I can to paraphrase. So oftentimes Americans will think to themselves, like, oh, is Roe going to be overturned? But really the question, especially this spring, as the court evaluates the Texas abortion restrictions in its case this term, is how the court is going to interpret Casey. So in 1992, the Supreme Court evaluated a number of restrictions out of Pennsylvania that were sort of models of the current legislation that's been passed across the country in recent years. And in Roe, originally, states were given the ability to regulate abortion after viability primarily. So they had much more leeway in the second and third trimesters. But Casey says that states have more leeway throughout the course of a pregnancy, so from the moment of fertilization. And O'Connor proposed this idea of the undue burden standard, meaning that the court will evaluate a restriction based on whether it poses a, quote, undue burden on a woman. But interestingly, I found that anti-abortion lawyers, since soon after Roe, had proposed various iterations of the undue burden standard as part of their long-term strategy to kind of deflate Roe or make call it central holding in question, into question.
And so here we are in 2016, where we are seeing so many restrictions at the state level. I mean, we can't even keep up with what is happening. In the last couple of weeks, we had anti-abortion and, we have to say, anti-women's health legislation, because not only are they targeting abortion, but by shutting down these clinics, you can no longer get pap smears or breast exams. You name it. So we had legislation this in the past couple of weeks in Florida, Utah, and Indiana. And a lot of people don't realize how that's connected to what happened in 1992.
Right. So in 1992, the court basically said, well, this is what's up for grabs, is what exactly the court said. But many lower court judges have interpreted the law to say that states can pass these laws, but the Casey decision from 1992 is a very muddled, murky decision, in part because this undue burden standard is pretty subjective. Like, what is an undue burden, right? It's unclear, and many scholars and lawyers say that it gives judges a lot of discretion to come up with their own personal interpretation of what an undue burden is. So is it $100? Is it 200 extra miles to get to the clinic? Is it having to wait 3 days? And whether those things are a substantial obstacle to you probably depends on what your life is like. Like, are you a working mother who gets paid $7 an hour? So $100 is very different than to, for example, an attorney who, may make quite a bit more money than that, and it's not such a big deal to pay an extra $100 in a tank of gas. So there's a lot of kind of race and class questions that are embedded in these questions, but I'm not sure, and this goes back to actually to the previous conversation you're having with Rafia, in terms of how much the American public sees those questions, you know, how much they see who's being affected by this and who counts and who doesn't count, and quite a lot of it depends, many advocates say, on sort of your class position or your financial resources.
Right. Well, and Jody, what are your thoughts about that? I mean, when you look at media coverage of these issues and these restrictions, your writers and at Rewire point this out, and Megan pointed it out in her piece, one quarter of Texas women whose nearest clinic closed after HB2 in Texas, they now live about 139 miles from an abortion provider. And if they have thousands of dollars, they can fly out of state, for example. But so many women don't have those means.
Well, for one thing, I just want to underscore something that Megan just said that I think is really, really critical, that this is an issue based on race, class, and immigration status, because the lower you are on any of those ladders, the greater the burden becomes for anything, you know, never mind just abortion care, but for anything, but particularly for abortion care, because there's an entire industry out there trying to make it more difficult and more difficult and more difficult. But I think, you know, part of our problem is twofold. One, we've failed to educate the public on these things because we've polled about Roe v. Wade, we've reassured people that Roe v. Wade is still in place for decades without really explaining to them that it really means nothing unless you have access, and Casey was all about access. And the second thing is that we always ask this question, and this is something that I'm starting to write about, you know, what is the state interest in potential life? Well, what is the state interest in the lives and aspirations of women? Of women who have aspirations for their lives, for their daughters and sons, for education, for income? We don't turn the question around. And by really looking at this whole undue burden thing, it's a question about how willing we are to devalue the lives of women and the concerns that they have. And I don't think we ask that question ever, but it's really fundamentally what this is about.
So what explains this? Because now is the perfect time for the media to really dive into these issues, as Donald Trump is receiving endless coverage for telling Chris Matthews that if abortion were illegal, women who get them should undergo, quote, some form of punishment, end quote. He has since backtracked. With a few exceptions, MSNBC's Rachel Maddow, Think Progress, a few others, but most media outlets have really failed to report that women have already been punished for having abortions in states with restrictions. In some cases, they're being mandated to have children. Jody, I mean, this is a perfect opportunity for the media to look at these issues.
Absolutely. Well, what we're really talking about is forced gestation. I mean, that's the bottom line. We are saying to women, no matter whether or not you want to become pregnant, and no matter the circumstances under which you become pregnant or under which your pregnancy proceeds, you will remain pregnant, irrespective of your desires and wishes. And that is forced gestation. And I think the media is failing for a number of reasons. You know, one thing I think is very little looked at. It's how many of the men in many of the leading media positions, like Chris Matthews, like Lawrence, like some others, you know, E.J. Dionne, who grew up in the Catholic Church and will oftentimes talk about being altar boys, and who are very cozy with the bishops and who bring bishops and priests on their programs to talk about these things, they are deeply uncomfortable with talking about these issues. And the Democratic Party has remained deeply uncomfortable with owning and talking about these issues as public health, as human rights issues, or even saying the word abortion. And so, you know, marry those things with the sort of underlying attitude that most people have, whether or not they admit it, that women are responsible for getting pregnant, they must be sluts. You know, you marry that with that underlying assumption. I mean, look at what it said at the last Supreme Court argument. Maybe these women should take more time being more careful. That was said at the last Supreme Court argument by one of the anti-choice lawyers. So I think that we have a really deep problem in the media about unexamined prejudices among many of the leading media voices. And as Rafia mentioned earlier, among, you know, the people that are in charge of wire services and newspapers, most of which are men.
Megan, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I would agree with, you know, everything Jody just said. Another thing that I think is really important is, I mean, I knew nothing about this stuff until I was assigned a story, I should say, by a woman editor some years ago. And this is not my interpretation. This is something that anti-abortion attorneys have directly told me. These laws are designed to seem like not a big deal, and they're designed to sort of make our eyes glaze over. If we, you know, if you think about some of these restrictions, like, okay, a waiting period, okay, something about ambulatory surgical centers, how many people in the general public even know what an ambulatory surgical center even is? Mm. So they're designed to not go directly at Roe. They're designed to sort of take this side door, and by their very nature, many people in the mainstream public who don't spend very much time thinking about abortion are not going to be keyed in to the long-term strategy.
Exactly.
Because none of these things on their own seem like they're that big of a deal, and I honestly really thought that some of them were for women's health before doing this reporting, and now I know they're not because I am interpreting it that way, but because people have actually laid out the legal strategy for me. So that, I mean, I know for me personally, that's why I was not as clued in, and it seems to me that must be the case for the general public.
Exactly. I totally agree with you, Megan. I really think that's a big problem, and in fact, I just called that exact issue the web of entrapment in the piece that mm-hmm. I just wrote, because it's this incremental laying of literally landmines toward getting abortion care that all mm-hmm. of a sudden you can't cross the field because it's littered with landmines. And
right.
then you imprison women for trying to, you know, for trying to get there.
Well, Megan.
Oh, no, and I was going to say that is also part of the problem in terms of judging, evaluating these laws, because they're evaluating a couple laws at a time, and there can be these caveats, and there are all these very particular things. A panel of judges may be like me before doing this reporting and not consider, you know, as I said before, 100 miles or an extra 48 hours, a quote, substantial obstacle or severe limitation, which is what they need to consider these things before they're unconstitutional, according to Casey.
Megan Winter is a freelance journalist. Her latest feature, Roe v. Wade, was lost in 1992, is published in Slate. I understand you spent about a year on this piece, Megan?
Yeah, I should qualify by saying not full time, but yeah,
wow.
I started it about a year ago. I had no idea what I was getting myself into. And I think that's another point, is there's not a lot of support for investigative journalism mm-hmm. or the kind of nuance, you know, movement work and journalism are very similar, especially when you're writing on behalf of disenfranchised people. So I could have done something better if I'd written a story about, you know, tacos or something else. So that's another inherent problem, which is why many of these nuanced stories across the board about, you know, every topic we have are often, they don't make it to the surface.
Well, right, and you get paid pennies for writing a piece
mm-hmm.
like this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
well, I hope you can all read this. It's a lengthy piece. Maybe you can print it out and read it over the weekend. You can find it at yourcallradio.org. And then also read Jody's piece, Jody Jacobson, who's editor-in-chief of Rewire, Punish Women for Abortion, Spare the Outrage. That is the mainstream anti-choice position. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. So we've had so many debates on the Republican side. All of the Republican candidates support overturning Roe v. Wade. Some support exceptions for rape and incest. Others don't. And it took Chris Matthews with MSNBC this many months later to finally ask a candidate questions about this. And Donald Trump said he supports punishing women. Now he's backtracking. So what are your thoughts about all of the media attention this is getting? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org, or you can send us a tweet. Our handle is yourcallradio. So let's talk about how these laws are being reported. So we've got new laws in Florida, Utah, and Indiana. In Utah, doctors are now required to give some women anesthesia. So here's how the New York Times reported this. Quote, "The governor of Utah, Gary Herbert, a Republican, has approved a bill that makes Utah the first state to require doctors to give anesthesia to women having an abortion at 20 weeks of pregnancy or later. The legislation is based on the disputed premise that a fetus can feel pain at that point," end quote. Again, the piece said, "The legislation is based on the disputed premise Jody, many doctors have already said that that is bogus, and yet in this New York Times piece, they call it disputed.
Yes, and that is a major problem in all of this. The American College of OBGYNs, the International College of OBGYNs, which is known as FEGO for short, you know, the American Pediatric Society, all of these medical institutions have reviewed the research and debunked the idea that there is fetal pain at 20 weeks. The nervous system simply is not developed in the right way, nor is the brain. And yet, I see this in newspapers now, especially the New York Times. Sometimes they'll get stuff right, and sometimes they'll get stuff utterly wrong. And it's almost like they've never had a paper-wide discussion about how they should report accurately on these issues. And so you find these things scattered throughout, and you're giving credence to a group of people who are known to lie. So I'm really baffled by this, you know, even the equivalency issue, because one assumes that you give equivalency to two people who have, you know, various interpretations of a set of facts that are agreed upon. But there are no facts here. There are no facts here that this side has. They create facts. They make up facts. They're not even facts. You can't make it up. And so I wonder where the paper that calls itself the paper of record comes out to legitimize these things in its reporting. I find it really, really distressing.
Megan, did you want to jump in?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really... I mean, I guess I have a slightly different perspective because I find myself, it's incredibly difficult to, just as Jody said, draw a line in terms of, or maybe this is not what you said, what people consider fact and what people consider opinion is basically, I mean, I remember when I was on another radio show and I repeated the fact that most of the medical establishment has rejected the idea that ambulatory surgical centers are required for most abortions, which is a fact. And the interviewer then, in a kind of sharp voice, asked me if I was taking an opinion. And what I had said was a fact. So, and that kind of put me on the defensive because in that particular situation, I did very much want to seem objective because I had written this piece that was... it was for Business Week, and it was very numbers-oriented. And what I had said was not an opinion. So I think it's really hard for journalists who are operating in good faith to, one, navigate all this stuff because it's so many people present. It's very hard to navigate what actually is a fact when there are so many people who, you know, will either totally agree, say things that are just on their face untrue, and other times you're accused of stating your opinion when you are, in fact, stating a fact.
I mean, the problem there is that it undermines a basic principle of journalism and journalistic ethics, and it's rampant within the media environment that, for some reason, if you state a fact, a public health fact, you are having an opinion that's
right.
Malleable. And, you know, let's look at the vaccine issue. I mean, do we need to call Jenny McCarthy every time there's a vaccine issue? Jenny McCarthy has created innumerable problems in public health. You know, do we need to listen to Chris Christie, who is ready to put people in, you know, whatever you call it, I forget the word that I'm looking for, confinement because of, you know, coming back from working in Africa for absolutely no medical reason, but he created a panic. And so the point is that there are lives and there's public health at stake, individual rights and public health. I think the media is terrible on this, and succumbing to those things is really problematic because I know that it's intimidating to be put in that position, but that is the problem.
Right. No, I agree. No, I'm not, yeah. I definitely
agree
with that.
Yeah, no, I know you're not. I'm just saying, yeah.
Right, no, and it made me mad that this guy basically said I was being partisan, and there were other things that I said that were more partisan, but that he had seized on that, which was, it's a fact, and the medical establishment does reject most, if not all, of the anti-abortion movement, you know, claims. So, I mean, that's a fact. It also supports a pro-choice argument in general.
Well, we have a caller on the line who's been patiently waiting, so I want to just make sure we get her in. Sasha in San Francisco. Hi, Sasha.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say I really appreciate this conversation because I've been following it, stories here and there, and it is true, it's hard to find good stories, but I wanted to call out two stories. The Daily Beast had a really well-written story on the result of Texas, their fetal pain law, which forced a woman to take a dying fetus home and wait for it to die before they could do it. Horrible story, but it's they actually interview the husband. They talk about the. It was just a really a story that really talks about the real world consequences to all these laws that are being put into place and what it really means to people who take them home. You know, who have to live with them. And so, really fascinating story. They actually have another story today about another woman who doesn't want to have an abortion but has to because of things going on. And so they're talking about how it really affects real live people, not potential people, but real live people who are having to deal with these laws. So I thought that was really fascinating. And the website Feministing has been covering abortion from a lot of angles. And one of the things that I hadn't really seen covered anywhere was all the lawyers that got together and told their abortion stories to the Supreme Court recently. And I haven't really seen that covered anywhere, and I'm trying to remember where I did see it covered recently, but it was really fascinating because women were, you know, lawyers, female lawyers were stepping up and saying, hey, I had an abortion, this is what it meant to me, this is why it's important to keep this available, and I just really didn't see that anywhere. So I just kind of wanted to throw those things out as, but particularly to call out the Daily Beast for actually telling a story that I think is important.
Thank you. That's really important, and I'm so glad you called in, Sasha. And I'll just say that Trapped, we did a show about that documentary a couple of weeks ago that looks at what's happening in Texas, for example. They talked to clinic workers who say that a 13-year-old girl who was raped cannot get an abortion because of these restrictive laws. Find that at yourcallradio.org, and that documentary is in theaters now. I want to thank our guest today, Jody Jacobson, editor-in-chief of Rewire. They cover all of these issues extensively. And Megan Winter, her piece, Roe v. Wade Was Lost in 1992, is published at Slate. Jody and Megan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you so both.
Much. Thank you. And Bye. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we're kicking off our week-long series examining the toxic chemicals in our everyday lives. On our first show, The Intercept's investigative reporter Sharon Lerner will join us to talk about chemical regulations. There are more than 60,000 chemicals in the U.S. that have no regulatory oversight. Manufacturers do not have to disclose the chemicals they use in their products. So what is being done to close these loopholes and ensure the chemicals are safe? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
What do folk and jazz have in common? Not much, but this Saturday on Folk Music and Beyond, we'll explore the intersections between the two genres. Irish singer Melanie O'Reilly incorporates elements of jazz into traditional music. We'll also hear Irish songs with jazz influences by Nuala Kennedy, Moira Ní Hachasek, and Savorna Stevenson. From this country, music by Cassandra Wilson, Doris Henderson, guitarist Karen Siegel, Wake the Dead, and Hawaiian harper Angela Lauren. That and more on Folk Music and Beyond this Saturday starting at 3, here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco. We'll be right back.
Welcome to Inflection Point, conversations with women changing the status quo. I'm Lauren Schiller. Today on Inflection Point, what's it really mean to do a man's job?
When you succeed doing this quote unquote man's work, it's not taken as proof that women can do this work. It's taken as proof that you're an exceptional woman.
Why would you let a total stranger into your home with an armful of clothes?
I think shopping sucks. It really, really sucks. And so I'm really, really going to fix it.
Maria Klemperer-Johnson, founder of Hammerstone Carpentry School for Women, and Diane Laviglio, founder of in-home styling service Boone & Gable. That's today on Inflection Point. Stay tuned.